Solve, secure, protect. Look to Patel for the independent thinking and cross-disciplinary focus it takes to advance security and safety in a changing world. They provide their clients with integrated solutions that secure our nation and help solve challenges within infrastructure, environment, emerging threats, and deployable mission-ready technology. Their teams leverage their deep expertise to develop science and technology for a healthier, safer, and more sustainable world. Visit Patel.org to learn how Patel makes the impossible possible. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, or EMSO. I'm your host, Ken Miller, Director of Advocacy and Outreach for the Association of Old Crows. Thanks for listening. Before we get to this episode, I want to quickly say Happy New Year and hope 2023 is off to a great start for all of our listeners. As we head into the new year, we're going to be making some changes aimed at helping our listeners engage a bit more directly. And the first out of the gate is on social media. You can now follow me and the show on Twitter at FTCNhost. We'll be giving you a heads up on some recordings, upcoming episodes, and providing a forum to discuss some of the topics that we cover here on the show, as well as you can submit questions, comments, and insights. So again, you can tweet or direct message me at FTCNhost. Now, on this episode of From the Crow's Nest, I am pleased to have with me a team from Draper. Here on the show, we wanted to dive deeper into microelectronics supply chain and technology challenges and opportunities that are on the horizon. So I invited Ms. Jen Santos from Draper and her team here to the show at AOC headquarters in Alexandria. Due to the depth and breadth of the conversation that we had, we decided to turn it into two episodes. So this is part one of that conversation, and part two of that conversation will come out at our next regularly scheduled episode on January 25th. Draper is an independent nonprofit engineering innovation company. They focus on the design, development, and deployment of advanced solutions for the world's most challenging problems. Developing new technologies to safeguard the U.S. military electronics supply chain, they are supporting microelectronics through nearly all of U.S. Department of Defense's activities. They enable such things as global positioning systems, GPS, radar, communications, and C2, or command and control. Draper views domestic sourcing and manufacturing of semiconductors as a matter of national security. They are helping to build trusted foundries and a thriving microelectronics sector across the U.S. So they are deeply involved in nearly every aspect of this issue, and I wanted to have them on the show to go into more depth than we often can in a regular episode. I was pleased to have with me Ms. Jen Santos. She is the Chief of Corporate Strategic Initiatives Office at Draper. Jen has more than 23 years of national security leadership experience in DOD, Congress, and the private sector, and has focused on this issue from many different perspectives over the course of her career. I was also pleased that she was joined by Senior Program Manager David Hegerstrom and Laboratory Fellow Jeremy Freifeld. David has been with Draper for over 20 years, developing highly customized, highly miniaturized microelectronic systems to address critical national security needs. He started his career at IBM's Semiconductor Division, where he contributed to several generations of world-leading memory and logic products. Dave witnessed firsthand the decline of U.S. leadership in manufacturing semiconductors and semiconductor packaging, and is involved in Draper's strategic initiatives to contribute to a resurgence of U.S. leadership in critical microelectronic manufacturing. Jeremy serves as Draper's technology portfolio leader for system assurance, including security, radiation hardening, fault tolerance, and system resilience technologies. Previously, he led all electronic development at Draper, giving him over 20 years of experience on microelectronics as well. So I want to thank Jen, David, and Jeremy for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. Let's listen into our conversation. Thank you for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
So I wanted to take a few minutes to kind of drill down to really help us understand the problem. We recently had an episode on From the Crow's Nest where we talked about a new book, Chip War, by Chris Miller. And reading that book, the thing that came out to me was that the history of this topic of microelectronics, the supply chain, the technology is so rich and reaches so far back into really our national consciousness for decades, and has really played a central role in industrial competitiveness and national security in almost every aspect of our lives, and we don't really even know it today. So, you know, we're here today. We recognize this problem of microelectronics, and I wanted to turn to Draper here. And I'll start with you, Jen. You know, can you give us a little bit of insight into, okay, we're here in 2022. We have this huge problem, policy problem in front of us, industrial-based problem that we're trying to address. How did we get here? And how would you define the problem today?
Yeah, no, Ken, thank you so much for, one, allowing Draper the opportunity to spend some time with you this morning, and to the Association of Old Crows for hosting such a prestigious conversation. I also want to thank my teammates, Dave and Jeremy here, who are excited to be a part of this conversation. So let's dive right in. What is the problem and how did we get here? So can we define what is the U.S. industrial base? So commercial industrial base is companies that create technologies and innovations that are vital to our livelihood. Defense and national security are companies that create technologies and innovation that are vital to our national security, such as technologies used by warfighters, critical infrastructure, to name a few. And then there's this term dual use, technologies that can be used in our livelihood and also national security and vice versa. So that's how the United States dissects its industrial base. How does China dissect its industrial base? So if you would look at U.S. companies perceive these as separate and distinct. You work for national security, you work for commercial, or you build something that can be applied in both cases, but with definitely different roles and restrictions. For example, U.S. companies typically have a federal business unit that markets to national security interests separate from their commercial business units. Unlike the United States and most Western nations, China commercial technologies and industries are inextricably linked in their defense efforts. The deliberate transfer of commercial technology and innovation to defense is not exclusive to China, is practiced by other adversarial states. Now, considering that, you think of industry partners having joint ventures with industry, other countries and other companies. And so that when you think of the microelectronics industrial base, it has gone through a lot of industry consolidation, right? So you've had the industry partners that are building certain parts of the supply chain consolidating, as well as building relationships with other countries. And so you have this consolidation happening. You have this, new fight towards who can make the smallest, fastest processor. And now you're where we are, right? The United States industrial base in the microelectronics industrial base has consolidated and has shrunk. The growth in those industrial bases focus on national security, which is where we're here to talk about. National security is 1.5% of that market. So it isn't a driver.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on that. When you talk about the U.S. industrial base, you know, you mentioned that there's the commercial piece, there's the national security piece. There's a level of complication to the U.S. industrial base. And you mentioned some of the consolidation that's happened and how that consolidation has affected the commercial, national security, or dual use aspects. Mm-hmm. And then the China piece, but then you have other Asian countries, as well as, of course, countries in Europe, which complicated. So, you know, when we think about, you know, U.S.-China competition, keeping our eyes on Asia for a little bit, there's a lot of other Asian partners and other markets in there, you know, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, obviously. How do they approach this from, you know, is it more of a U.S. perspective? Do they figure out a way to kind of balance in terms of how they divide up their industrial bases?
No, they whatever they build for commercial is used in national security. And so you don't have this industrial base that's competing for either or, it's just for, right? And so, which allows to have a larger demand signal to support the problem.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to mention that the Asian countries like Taiwan, which produce a lot of semiconductors, realized decades ago that they could use that to drive economic growth, right? So forgetting the national security aspect, I'm going to back up 1 second and say the problem is that microelectronics dictate both any kind of adversarial advantage we have from national security perspective. So they completely dictate the capability of our weapon systems. And two, they're the number one economic driver for the world at this point. So 7 of the top 10 of the largest market cap companies in the world are microelectronic companies. And so not only are they important for national security, but they're also forgetting national security for countries that are trying to lift themselves up economically. They're the driver. And, you know, the Taiwanese, the Asian countries realized this decades ago, and they invested heavily from a government subsidy standpoint into standing up the capability to allow the U.S. to offshore microelectronic production. And so that has gotten them into, you know, a wealthy nation status and provided a different way of life for their entire citizenship. So I think that it's both a national security and an economic competitiveness imperative for everyone around the globe. That includes the Europeans, that includes, you know, the Chinese and the Asians, and it also includes us, because as we see the industry slipping away, not only are we losing any kind of advantage that we currently enjoy from a national security perspective, but we're also losing that economic competitiveness advantage, and we won't be the pinnacle of technology or R&D development anymore.
And so Jen, you mentioned, Jeremy, that, you know, they made a decision decades ago to go in a particular direction. And Jen, you know, you talked about the consolidation and all the changes happening in the U.S. industrial base. Could you talk a little bit about how this has evolved, where the U.S. Competitiveness in microelectronics has evolved to it while watching what's happening over in Asia and the decisions they're making over the decades? Because obviously we've been watching what they've been doing. This isn't a problem that's all of a sudden on our laps and we are not aware of it. We've seen it happening. We've seen it evolve in front of us. So why now are we all of a sudden, you know, by and large alarmed that, okay, we have a problem we have to address?
Well, for national security, in the national security spaces, they don't buy a microelectronic. They buy a plane, a ship, a truck, right, a submarine. They don't buy a microelectronic chip. They don't. It's not an aggregated demand signal. And so what does that mean? A builder of any of those weapon systems uses their supply chain to build whatever they need to build. And so if they need a microelectronic, they will outsource that to an industry partner to go build it. Well, if you're outsourcing it to an industry partner, your job is to drive down costs and increase speed. And so if you can offshore some of those capabilities to other countries to fill the demand signal, now you've lost the opportunity to have that capability onshore, which as a result of that conversation, and Jeremy made a fantastic point of a lot of the national security is economic security in this space. It absolutely is. Microelectronics sits at that intersection. And so as industry partners offshored their capabilities to do packaging at other places like TSMC, now you don't have that capability in the United States. Do you need to have that capability in the United States? So industry is debating, right? From a Draper's perspective, we consider that the supply chain, assured supply chain, is instrumental to national security. And so we keep that as an important perspective and we understand what's going on in that industrial base. So that offshoring has driven to results like the CHIPS Act, right? The CHIPS Act is a result of industry, government realizing that we probably need to invest similar to what countries did 10 years ago into the United States, into microelectronics and focus that conversation.
You mentioned the CHIPS Act, so we can just touch on that a little bit, and I'm sure we'll revisit it throughout the conversation. But the CHIPS Act signed into law in August after a lot of debate on Capitol Hill, and it's a multi-billion-dollar investment plan that covers not only the building of manufacturing sites, but also tax credits and so forth. So what are some of the pieces of the CHIPS Act that you think are going to be the most instrumental in moving this conversation forward? Jeremy?
The CHIPS Act, even though it's multi-billion, pales in comparison to foreign government investment. So both the European Union as well as, you know, the Eastern nations invest far more into their industry than the U.S. does. And that's part of the original problem is that, you know, the U.S. doesn't directly invest into our commercial industrial base, right? Capitalism, you know, market forces are what drive our development instead of direct government subsidies. And so the CHIPS Act is like kind of like a trying to catch up, but it's way smaller than, you know, what people are doing offshore.
The CHIPS Act is a signal to industry, the executive branch and legislative branch, from the legislative branch saying, all right, we're listening, okay. Right? And so it's brought a conversation to this country, right? Before that, was there a conversation about microelectronics vulnerabilities? I'm just going to say I used to work in the Pentagon and I would run around the building screaming, microelectronics is our number one national security risk. I did it all the time for years. And so because I saw what was happening, I understood the Made in China 2025 and the Made in China 2020. I understood where they were going. And I understood that our industry partners here in the United States were saying, we're just going to offshore what we're building. We're going to offshore packaging. It's okay. But when that spigot is shut off, things will change.
You have to start somewhere, and it's a right. good start. And the other thing that the CHIPS Act does that I think is really great is that it intentionally prevents kind of the money getting into foreign control, mm-hmm. which is pretty unique from a legislative perspective, I believe. So
yes, absolutely.
So I think that is one of the good things about the CHIPS Act that I think we need to, you know, just follow it up with more money, more investment and more development.
And Jeremy, this is, I'll add to that. Adversarial capital, which you brought up a couple minutes ago, is complex and growing threat to the U.S. industrial and technological base. We not only need to illuminate the supply chain, we do need to illuminate the ownership chains. So as an example, the CRS, Congressional Research mm-hmm. Service, has done this summary of the Made in China 2025, their clear Chinese industrial policy. And that umbrella was introduced in 2015. It seeks to boost Chinese economic competitiveness by advancing China's position in the global manufacturing value chain, leapfrogging into emerging technologies, and reducing reliance on foreign firms. So if our industry partners recognize this as a vulnerability, they won't take on adversarial capital or adversarial influence, which is again a great signal, because in that bill, just like in the Small Business Administration reauthorization, said none of these funds can go to adversarial countries, right? Which is changing the conversation, mm-hmm. right? 20 years ago, industry was encouraged to offshore. Now industry partners are saying, wait, hold on, let me reassess.
Yeah, I guess, Jen, I liked your comment about the CHIPS Act being a signal that we're listening. I've been around the microelectronics industry for quite a few years, and we didn't get in this situation quickly where we have no competitive manufacturing here in the United States. And we certainly won't get back in that position very quickly. And I think it's a good start. I think, you know, the driving force for going offshore was really low cost. I was actually at IBM from the early 80s to the early 90s, and I saw sort of this hump from IBM being very dominant in microelectronics. IBM was actually the largest American producer of chips. But they were all for internal consumption for decades, so their name doesn't always come to the top of the list as sort of the leaders in semiconductors, but they were for many years. And in the late 80s, IBM started doing packaging offshore in order to get their own chips packaged more, you know, less expensively. And that trend was driven by largely consumer demand, the consumer demand for low-cost electronics. And now I think there's a different tone in this country. There's an awareness that both economically and national defense-wise, there's other factors to consider besides lowest cost. So I think we're on the cusp of something really important, and hopefully going forward, you know, we really will see these changes we're talking about.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank Battelle for their continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. It's always great to hear from them, and I am pleased to be here with Rusty Colmorgan, Navy veteran and division manager at Battelle. Rusty, thanks for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
You've had an interesting career with extensive stints in the Navy and industry. What brought you to Battelle, and how does your experience align with Battelle's mission?
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. And I did have a very rewarding career as a Navy pilot. And as I transitioned through a number of companies in industry, I continued to have great experiences because I got the chance to work alongside eye-watering technical talent. What I'm most excited about at Battelle is how our campus is literally surrounded by an impressive depth of relevant applied researchers. That uniquely embedded in-house research capability serves as a foundation as we focus on solutions to the world's hardest problems. We strive to create a better world through science, and the RavenStar technology is the latest example of a hard problem with wide society benefits.
In the past, we've heard here on From the Crow's Nest from your colleagues, Doug Thornton and Molly Engel. They provided some intriguing insights about the RavenStar antenna. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about the challenges of this trade space and what you're trying to address with this game-changing technology?
Well, the bottom line is that users have had to sub-optimize their capabilities and needs with traditional design approaches in the RF spectrum. Traditionally, electronic warfare and command and control users want a number of capabilities that create a challenging design space. Those needs are typically long ranges, maximum throughput, and low probability of intercept, low probability of detection. They want those ranges for more effective operational reach or standoff, and they want more throughput for the increased data that leads to actionable intelligence. And those tight control of the emissions, they want those for either maximizing energy on a particular bearing or limiting the ability to detect or interfere with their emissions. It's not an easy trade space, but the flexibility of the RavenStar architecture gives them more of what they want operationally.
So what does the RavenStar do that makes it optimized across these critical performance needs, and how does that stand out from traditional approaches?
Well, our frequency agility gives operators flexibility to work an ultra-wide portion of the spectrum through a single low-swap software-defined aperture. RavenStar co-designed extremely wide-band aperture arrays with co-located advanced electronics. This allows a compact, frequency-flexible RF solution. Our approach minimizes conventional antenna feature trade-off and allows significant design flexibility for delivering the spectrum dominance that's needed.
We've been tracking this program here on the show. How mature is RavenStar today?
We put it at a TRL 6 after the testing that we've done in December of 2023, and continuing into this year, we'll do field tests, accompany lab demonstrations, and development performance on formal efforts with different DoD customers, all that are pointed toward a continued maturation of the RavenStar design. They show the RavenStar's ability is to support all domain missions that require multiple communications.
Well, thank you, Rusty, for joining me here on the show. It's always great to hear from the Battelle team. And now it's time to get back to our show.
So I want to follow that up real quickly, because I was going to get into that a little bit to see, is it enough? Because, you know, you look at these large price tags and you almost become numb to them at some point. It's like, oh, it's $54, $60, $70 billion. But when you think of like all of government annual appropriations and all that we're investing in a number of different programs, it doesn't seem that as significant. So, but I know that there's some subsidies for manufacturing. There's some tax credits. There's some investment in R&D. So, what are some of the pieces that you're most interested in to see how they evolve? Because obviously, a lot of this is promised money authorizations in the future. There's some immediate money, but you know, this is going to be an annual debate that we're going to be coming back to. So what are some of the pieces that you're looking at?
So again, in national security, you don't buy a microelectronic. And so you buy a plane, a ship, a sub. And so investing $52 billion, which the CHIPS Act, the portion for the microelectronics is $52 billion, $50 billion through commerce and $2 billion for Defense Department. Is that enough? No, absolutely not. And it's not, I mean, I'm a prior appropriator. Throwing money at the problem doesn't solve the problem. It's got to be a collective understanding across industry, executive, and legislative branch. The three have to agree that we have this problem and have to invest internally with the industry partners. The executive branch has to recognize the vulnerabilities associated with not having this capability in the United States, and the legislative branch has to support, but it has to be together. It can't be, you know, let's just put some money in the appropriations bill and it will solve that. Having done that before, it doesn't even move the needle, because in truth, right? You'll build up an industrial partner, like using the Defense Production Act, you'll build up an industrial partner, and then the government won't even contract with those industry partners. And so it can't just be throw money at the problem. It has to be a recognition for industry to recognize that if their reliance is on a single or sole source supplier that could shut off the valve at any point in time based on whatever reason they come up with, it is a massive risk to that industry partner. That's step one with the industry side. The executive branch, that's the executive branch, not just the Defense Department, the whole executive branch has to recognize that if we lose this capability, we will then not be able to rebuild it back up again. And the legislative branch has to support the industry and executive branch to get this moving in the right direction. But it's $50 billion isn't going to solve it. China is invested. There's so many news articles out about there about where they're making investments and what fabs they're building up. They're talking at hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. But the difference that they have is they have direct and clear direction that their industry partner has to go do this. Whereas we're a free and open market economy. We absolutely would not do that.
Jeremy?
Oh, I just wanted to add that, you know, the other ways that the governments and the offshore industry uses their money is to procure technology from the U.S. So a lot of that money isn't going to build native capability, but it's going to just buy our capability and move it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I cue Jen up for this because I know that she's very into the concept of integrated deterrence and adversarial capital. So, Jen?
Yeah, no, I mean, it is all about following the money, right? Investing into these industry partners is really important right now. And having the industry partners, and I use the partners word there on purpose. I do it all the time, whether it's the executive branch partners or legislative branch partners. It has to be a partnership, right? And together, collectively, the government agencies that have the authorities to support and help. The Department of Justice has amazing authorities to support the industry in these cases. Department of Commerce, U.S. Trade, USTR, DOD, have all these authorities to help industry maintain and grow its competitiveness in this space. And integrated deterrence, which Jeremy brings up, is a passion of mine, which is really bringing those collective executive branch authorities together to protect and promote the U.S. industrial base and our partners and allies. I mean, I just touched on partners and allies. It's such an imperative that we bring our partners and allies into this conversation and share together. Again, they're investing as well. And when you collectively put it together, now you have a capability. But just a $50 billion appropriation bill isn't enough. It's not going to change the conversation.
Yeah. I want to touch on that a little bit more. You mentioned something earlier on, you know, DOD does not buy microchips, they buy planes. And there's a very similar argument that's made in our community when we're looking at electromagnetic operations, you know, and we deal a lot in the world of multifunction systems where we're getting away from this idea of buying a single box that does electronic warfare nowadays. It's a multifunction system that can do a lot of different things. And DOD has had a problem buying that because of the way that the acquisition system is set up. It's antiquated in a way that there is nobody that can say, I'm going to spend X amount on a multifunction system that's going to do a lot of different things, but I'm only responsible for this one particular capability or technology in it. So in that way of thinking, we've been pushing really hard for acquisition reform to kind of give us more flexibility in this. So this is a very similar situation. Do we have to rethink how DOD is buying things to allow them to have more flexibility in maybe not buying the chips, but buying that specific component technology so that they have greater flexibility in where they go across numerous systems and across the services?
Yeah, no, Ken, you're spot on. Does the DOD need to think differently about critical technologies and its weapon systems? Microelectronics is one component, but that's the component we're here to talk about. But does the DOD need to think about that? Yes. Does the executive branch need to think about that? Yes. Similar things, Department of Homeland Security, and look what they're working on, right? Very similar, right? But it has to be not just an aggregation of demand, but aggregation of knowledge, and then way to do things. There are industry partners out there looking at doing things like strategic sourcing. So mm-hmm. if I design this chip that can source a plane, a sub, or a truck, now I don't need a different variation for each one, right? And then I can make it assured, right? Add cyber vulnerability protections, all these things to it, technology protections to and use it in different formats. And so that's one way industry is looking at how do we aggregate the capabilities in a company to apply it to different problem sets for national security. That's just one of the ways.
It's interesting because you talk about aggregate demand. We focus a lot of that, you know, in terms of DOD, but you mentioned Homeland Security, and almost every other government agency there, and even when you get into outside of DOD and military, you have, critical infrastructure. There's a lot of similar aggregation of that same demand going on. Who is responsible for aggregating all the aggregation that's happening out there to kind of say, hey, there's a lot more we have in common than we have in differences. So who's that problem?
Who owns that problem? The National Security Council and the National Economic Council are the two organizations that bring the branches of government together, the executive branches, the cabinet level, together to talk about problems. So in my opinion, it's there. And I say that because, and I'm not saying they would do the acquisition, but they would be the one that understand it. And, you know, there's been a whole bunch of executive orders on this case to look at supply chain vulnerabilities, supply chain problems. And so the recent one a year ago, so under the previous administration, there was one. In this administration, there's been looks at this. And microelectronics has been one of the top problems, but then it gets back into, all right, so we're buying a plane, a ship, a truck, a satellite, a spaceship, right? I mean, you know, NASA, Homeland Security buying planes to protect the border. I mean, there are so many. So who could understand that demand? I think the NEC could understand that demand. And I would say, and then they could apply it strategically. Now, if you are on the industry side, let's flip this circle around. Does the industry want the National Security Council and the National Economic Council telling them what to do? No.
Probably not. Yeah.
No way. And so if, for Draper's perspective, we want to build microelectronics. We want to design the most exquisite microelectronics and provide it for the most exquisite national security problems. But we're going to do that on such a small set. But can we, if we collectively work with other industry partners, which we absolutely do, can we together do some type of tiering of them to apply one of these microelectronics, I always say this, and Jeremy and I giggle about it, to a pacemaker or to critical infrastructure or to a nuclear weapon, right? Could we design capabilities that could accommodate all of those? Well, that's what the dual use or the military civil fusion program in China does.
And I think that's why partnerships are so critically important. When we think partnerships, we think government to industry, but we also forget when you have really good partnerships, that industry to industry piece can also stimulate
Absolutely.
Creative solutions apart from what wherever the government is involved in, mm-hmm. Just by increasing the crosstalk and cross-pollination that happens there.
But you know the government is very stovepiped in those mm-hmm. areas. So if you go from commerce to NIH to DOD to DOC to USD, they're all well-functioning organizations, but their incentives aren't to aggregate or to coordinate. Their incentives are to protect their rice bowls mm-hmm. and solve their problems. There's no interconnective weave between there. That's what we think is a great opportunity.
Jeremy?
Oh, yeah, and we fight this battle every day because, as was quoted earlier, I think Jen said it, that microelectronic demand from a DOD perspective is 1.5%. But recently, the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering published a slide deck where if you aggregate the government demand, if you include FAA, DOD, critical infrastructure across all of government and look at government as an enterprise, they drive approximately 23% of domestic demand for microelectronics, which, I mean, you can think about, like, the government's a huge entity, even just as a PC procurement part for all of its employees, it's pretty huge in comparison to, you know, commercial companies. And so getting to that level where you have, 23, 24% of domestic demand, then you can start making an impact that isn't like contrary to commercial interests, but to, you know, in some kind of symbiotic way, work with the commercial industries in order to ensure that that 23-24% of mechatronics is produced domestically and with some assurance.
Yeah, and can I add on to Jeremy's point there? Going from 1.5 to a 23% ownership of that capability is game changing. So now you have industry that is interested in investing because they see a clear demand signal from the government, not just the individual agency.
Well, one of the changes that we has gotten some talk in the AOC that we're looking at closely is this, you know, how will this the CHIPS Act kind of stimulate this drive for talent in microelectronics? Because you know, you can put a lot of money into anything, but if you don't have the people, the right people in the right places, so this talent development is going to be important. And according to the bill, there's I guess an establishment of a national semiconductor technology center that's going to be responsible for this, working in partnership. Talk a little bit about some of the challenges with talent development, and what are some of the things that you're looking at to help with address that problem?
Well, microelectronics encompass several what I'll call for the moment sectors. People talk about chips, so silicon wafers become silicon chips. TSMC is the big, you know, the big kahuna right now in terms of manufacturing state-of-the-art silicon. But silicon needs to be connected to something. And so when we talk about semiconductor packaging, it's all about that connecting the silicon to something useful. Now, generally speaking, you're talking about connecting a piece of silicon to a circuit board. If you pop open your cell phone or your toaster, you'll see a little green board in there with components on it. That circuit board technology has also eroded in this country. So just like it's very difficult to source chips, it's very difficult to source those circuit boards that have been treated as a commodity, but have actually advanced technically very much in the last decade or so. So I have started some work with an organization associated, well, it's part of the University of New Hampshire. University of New Hampshire has a Center for Advanced Manufacturing, and there is a New Hampshire company that is arguably the leader in circuit board manufacturing in the United States right now. And Draper is working with both of them to add circuit board technology and advanced circuit board technology into the curriculum at the University of New Hampshire. And that's just one example. There's collegiate workforce development programs funded by the Department of Defense that are really, I think, gaining a lot of momentum.
Yeah, and so we have a huge issue with talent recruitment, both in the defense industrial base, but also in the commercial industrial base. That's one of the reasons that, kind of the dominoes fall, right, is because, you know, if the manufacture happens offshore, and then when you talk about manufacturing larger systems that include the microelectronics, like iPhones, right, they don't have enough engineering people in the United States to pull off iPhone production here in the U.S. And so it's just easier from a scale perspective to go offshore. So there's a whole host of kind of development programs, and especially indirect subsidies for companies that are working on workforce development. But I think the funny thing is, you know, one of the things from the CHIPS Act is that they developed a draft national strategy on microelectronics research and development. And they ask, they outline how they're going to stimulate venture capitalism and commercial investment into microelectronics. But from a workforce perspective, they're not addressing the individuals. And so one of the responses that Draper provided is like, you know, other countries are directly subsidizing specific degrees based on economic and defense needs, right? So is it less expensive at a public university, for example, to get an electrical engineering degree than it is to get an English literature degree? Right now it isn't. And so those are the types of kind of very different, against the grain from the traditional U.S. education paradigm that we're going to have to think about in the near future in order to maintain economic competitiveness in this space. Because there's no way we can do it with the amount of individuals we have now. And if you look at the kind of university departments, what you see is they're like even from, you know, 25 years ago when I graduated, the departments of engineering are much, much smaller now than they were then. Mm-hmm. It's gotten to the point where, you know, as a company, we're fighting over dozens of engineers as opposed to hundreds like in previous years.
Jen?
Yeah, and so at Draper, we have a program called Draper Scholars, and it's really to offset the cost for folks to get specialty degrees to support national security. And I mean, I know it's small in the big scheme of things for the country, but it's an investment into offsetting the costs for students to go get these degrees. We work with, Dave mentioned New Hampshire. We work with a whole bunch of universities across the country to help in this workforce development. But again, it's got to be all three of those branches mm-hmm. coming to that same conclusion, right? Offsetting costs for students to get their degrees, absolutely. Having job opportunities ahead of them. And so, you know, there's just not as many folks graduating with these engineering degrees. The demand signal for those jobs is way higher than the supply can fulfill.
And because of the American University prominence, you know, for the defense industrial base, recruiting U.S. citizens with these specialized degrees to work national security programs is exponentially harder than the commercial industry has. So the graduates from U.S. universities are, you know, a diverse mix of people, but they often take their education offshore now because that's where the jobs are. Mm-hmm. And so as that flows offshore, we just have less and less both U.S. citizens, but also, you know, foreign talent in the U.S. to kind of man the microelectronic domestic production.
At the top of the episode, we mentioned Chris Miller's book, Chip War. And in the book, he tells a story of Sony's Akio Morita talking about kind of Japan's investment plan. And he's like, you know, while U.S. was, he quotes him as saying, while the United States was busy creating lawyers, Japan has been busier creating engineers. And this is something that was a multi-decade initiative by them. What can we do to build a multi-decade initiative where we're focused on building engineers here in the United States more so than we have been in the past?
Well, so there's probably multiple angles of attack. I'm encouraged by sort of the 1,000 points of light possibility. I think there's growth in STEM education in communities. I think individual companies have an interest in developing the workforce, certainly not just Draper. But as Jen and Jeremy have said, there's also a top-down policy kind of reckoning that's going to be required too.
Yeah, and Jeremy. And to expand on that, I mean, I think that, you know, the cost of a university education in the country has gone up at such an inflationary rate compared to, you know, the average wage and things like that, that you're going to have to do control that in some way, but especially for these specialized degrees like electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, you're going to have some type of, incentive for students to choose that versus, you know, philosophy and medicine, for instance.
It starts at such a young age. It doesn't just start at the college phase, right? And so in order to change the hearts and minds of students in school right now, you have to get to them and show them that, you know, when I talked about commercial national security and dual use, folks the percentage of folks wanting to be in national security continues to decrease, right? And so if you get to the hearts and minds of them and describe this can be applied to X you know, a pacemaker, as I said, or an automotive industry partner or a critical infrastructure, oh, now it's a different conversation. But it has to start at such a young age. I know the Defense Department is investing in things like the industrial base analysis and sustainment. That portfolio is looking at project manufacturing. It's looking at how do we build more production lines and bringing in students at younger age and teaching them and evolving them. And so, you know, you have to start at a younger age to expose. You know, one of the jokes I've said is, this is on the software side of it, but when you have to learn a language in school, when you're going through your education, your K through 12, you have to learn a language. Why can't it be Java or Python? Because that's a totally different language and it drives a different behavior and a different way of thinking. And so we got to get to the younger students, educate them, offset their costs and incentives to go into these really complicated portfolios, and then offer them opportunities that aren't just national security.
Jeremy,
I just want to say, from a Draper perspective, we would prefer Rust as opposed to Java, for instance. But but anyways, the other thing I think the Defense Department is actually doing a really good job in investing in the universities themselves. So Dave mentioned UNH, but I'm going to shout out to Purdue University, mm-hmm. Georgia Tech, mm-hmm. Vanderbilt. UC Berkeley. So the Defense Department and, you know, is really investing into the workforce development in these programs, in the educators, directly funding educators to, you know, develop curriculums and stuff that are applicable to the defense industrial base. And I think that you see a lot of this. For instance, Intel used to have a very large university program. They've kind of offshored. They have a very large university program in Brazil now, which is very strange, but a very large university program to kind of indoctrinate people into the Intel methodology and way of working at the professor level. And so I think that you're going to have that top-down approach where you do that public-private partnership that comes out like the National Semiconductor Technology Center.
That will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. I want to thank my guests, Jen Santos, Jeremy Freifeld, and David Hagerstrom for joining me here for part one of our discussion. Part two will be released on January 25th. You can learn more about Draper by visiting their website at draper.com. Also, don't forget to review, share, and subscribe to this podcast. We always enjoy hearing from our listeners, so please take some time to let us know how we're doing. That's it for today. And again, you can follow me on Twitter at FTCNhost. Thank you for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Battelle, the world's largest independent, not-for-profit, applied science and technology organization. Since 1929, their mission has been to translate scientific discovery and technology advances to benefit society. Through markets such as health, environment, infrastructure, industry, and national security, Battelle has been delivering cutting-edge solutions that impact the well-being of the world and help keep us safe at home. To learn more, go to battelle.org/connect. That's BATTELLE.org/connect.